previously on Get in the Mecha.
Attack on Titan, I think, gains its strength, or at least has thrived off these more centralized arcs. But where do we draw the line between an arc which works solely by itself to mark a separate moment in Eldian history, for example? How does one allow these arcs to work together and flow together thematically, but also remain as divisions?
This is Get in the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it.
Welcome back to Get in the Mecha, I'm your host Jamal today, and in this episode we are looking at the Uprising arc of Attack on Titan. This will be the final arc on the podcast, which I'll be analyzing up until final season comes out. I'm going to go into that as soon as I just finish this intro. So this is the final one of the many arcs which we've done out of the Battle of the Trost District, the Clash of the Titans, the Female Titan, and the Return to Shiganshina. We are finally finishing with this one, and until season 4 or final season comes out, we will be pausing that, and I might start analyzing another show, but I have a lot of content prepared, so don't feel worried if you're thinking that Attack on Titan is never going to come back. It will, but I have some other things planned as well in the meantime. So in this episode, what I intend to focus on is really, what is really going on within this arc? I know that sounds kind of vague, but I think the nature of this arc is very information heavy. And so really just going through the information itself and picking up on some interesting points and some perceptive points, I think, which come out of this arc. There's a historical parallel, which I also want to talk about. It's more just a thing which I found out. I don't know if Isayama was influenced by it, but it's something quite interesting, which I want to share with you. And then we'll sort of return to the same notion of going into the information and some more specific things which I think the arc has to offer. I have a few things before we start today's episode. I will try to break them down really quickly. I have labeled them or put them into three different categories or 3 points. First point is the podcast has reached 1,000 listens, so the podcast has been listened to over 1,000 times now. I cannot thank you enough, it means a lot, and I know in comparison to other podcasts it might not be anything in how we're 35 episodes in, but I don't really care. I'm just happy for you to be here listening, and all of that is just an indicator of your support, so thank you so much regardless of the number. Thank you for just being here and giving your time. It really does mean a lot, and here is two more anime analysis. Secondly was just the point on Attack on Titan and this being the final arc analysis which we're doing. I have really enjoyed doing Attack on Titan arc analysis, but I've begun to like this show a lot more than I first did, and I don't think it's the perfect show, but when you look at a lot of the things which the show brings forward, you can tell that Isayama has really put all his sweat and blood into this one manga slash anime. And finally, this kind of links in a bit about just the world in general. This part doesn't relate though, but I am wearing a suit. And the reason why I'm wearing a suit, coincidentally, if you know where the stuff on coronavirus and blah blah blah, school kind of just got terminated. And I kind of said it as a meme that I'm going to wear a suit for the final episode of our arc analysis, specifically the Uprising arc. And I've delayed this episode for quite a while, to be honest. I don't know why, but I've delayed it for a long time. And I said I was going to wear a suit. I didn't know this was going to happen with coronavirus and blah blah blah. And I was wearing my old uniform because of memories from school, blah blah blah. I'm blah blah blahing a lot. And then in summary, I'm wearing a suit now by coincidence. I might make it a tradition to wear a suit for the finales of our arc analyses. I think that might be quite funny. If you guys do want that, I will post it on Twitter next time maybe. I'm not really ready to do it right now because 9 o'clock, if not 10 o'clock, and I'm feeling kind of emotional after everything which has been going on. I had to do some anime music therapy to kind of get myself in the mood for this episode, but I'm fine enough to do it now. As podcasters, it is our responsibility, or not our responsibility, but something we're doing at the moment, is trying to keep you guys distracted from all the hard-hitting news, and I can understand why, because it isn't very great news. It's usually quite bad news, which is spiraling through the media, and I understand that. And therefore, I'm not going to dwell on it. But I do want to reinforce just some of the things which have been said, specifically from other podcasters. I would highly recommend going over to Buildcasters. They said something on the Mecha PSA, or that's the most recent episode they did, the Mecha PSA. It's just a quick acronym as to what you should do in times like this. I would highly recommend it. It's really accessible. It's like 10 minutes. Really do recommend, and also just follow Buildcasters in general as well. Great mecha podcast. And so I tried to rush through that. Apologies for the slightly long intro. We don't usually have intros like this. Here is the episode for this week. That is episode 36 of Guess in the Mecha, The Uprising Arc. I'm not going to waste so much time as I did in the intro. So here are the alerts for today, that is, spoilers for the Uprising arc, both in the anime and the manga. We are referring to Attack on Titan 3rd Season Part 1 on my anime list and most list sites. It's just called Attack on Titan or Shingeki no Kyojin 3rd Season or Season 3, not 3rd Season Part 2, because that is the Return to Shiganshina arc. In case you're literally finished 3rd Season and you haven't seen the Return to Shiganshina, we are not discussing 3rd Season Part 2, only 3rd Season. Be sure to check the show notes. I have the story arcs link there, I believe. If not, just the arc page in general. Be sure to check out the chapters and chapter numbers in the case that you might be spoiled on certain events within the show so far, or the manga specifically. So let's get into it. Here is a plot summary for the Uprising arc of Attack on Titan. The Uprising arc takes a different approach to most arcs in Attack on Titan, mostly because within this arc, the Survey Corps take a counter-revolutionary role as opposed to the dominant militant role of which they take within Eldian society. The military police are not completely under control by the military police brigades, and instead there are some other members operating within the military police who usually wouldn't. This results in a conspiracy emerging against the scouts, and then they begin to antagonize them. Levi seems to know one of these leading members within these new military police, known as Kenny the Ripper. With all this chaos going on, Erwin discusses with Dot Pixis how they can manage to overthrow the royal government. This is also based on the fact that the true royal bloodline is of the Reese family and not those on the throne at the moment. Due to the fact that it is the Reese family, this means that Historia Reese, previously known as Krista Lenz, should be the queen on the throne at the moment. The antagonism against the Survey Corps only gets worse, and are forced to dodge the authorities after being falsely accused of murdering Demo Reeves, the head of the merchant group, the Reeves Company. We eventually meet a new character called Rod Reese, and this is the father of Historia Reese, or Krista Lenz. It is then revealed that Kenny and Rod are collaborating, and soon after kidnap Eren and take him into a dungeon. Within the dungeon, Historia is able to jog Eren's memory, where he sees the first time which he transformed into a titan, and sadly ate his own father, Grisha Jaeger. Part of Grisha's past is revealed, and we learn about how he managed to steal the titan powers of Historia's half-sister, Frida. However, after a wild intervention, Historia remembers her friend Ymir, and how she told her to live on in pride, and therefore helps Eren escape the dungeon. The Levi Squad also managed to get in and help Eren and Historia out. Rod Reese, being left behind, injects himself with Titan Serum, causing him to transform into what Hanji dubs as the Progenitor Titan. Towards the end of the arc, they manage to defeat the Progenitor Titan, or the Rod Reese Titan, at the Orvid District. So that is most of the arc, but I'm not really finished the plot summary. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go through a few more takeaways which came from this. If you made it this far, I'm assuming that you have watched this or read this already. but I'm going to just go through some takeaways, I think, which we get from here in terms of narrative, mostly just factual stuff. I just don't think it's very interesting to put it into a very musicy section. I just wanted to get the main stuff in. So by the end of the arc, we begin to learn about the life between Kenny and Levi, and Kenny's role in helping Levi learn survival skills as a young child. And also we learn about his relation with Uri Reis and how they had a whole thing going on. I'm going to go into that later more in detail. We also discuss the stuff to do with the immunity with the Archimans. That doesn't really come in at the end of the arc, but it's a very essential thing which I should mention. We learn about the immunity of the Archimans to the Scream ability, which we also learn about in the Clash of the Titans arc because the fact that Eren uses it himself. How he did that, I don't think we're very sure at this point. Levi receives a Titan serum, or a syringe of Titan serum, at his almost death at the tree. That can be used at a later date, although it isn't necessarily used within this arc. Historia is crowned queen, which makes a lot of sense. Monarchism wins this time. And finally, by the very, very end, Berthold and Reiner and the Beast Titan are all waiting to ambush the Survey Corps and retrieve the coordinates in the Shiganshina district once it comes. And now that, I think, is most of the arc. So as I said at the very beginning of the plot summary, I think one of the most interesting things is how the role of the Survey Corps has changed within this arc, and it sadly does feel kind of temporary, but at least it happens, and it's an altered perspective. They take almost a counter-revolutionary role. The notion of revolution is, I'm not really using that in a sort of philosophical, political context. I just mean that kind of just to mean it as is, in how they are willing to try and overthrow the government. And at the moment, they're not particularly, in the eyes of the law, at least within the system, they aren't seen as the good people at the moment because of the fact that they've been dethroned and defamed by these new military police. Their image has been tarnished, and therefore, as the arc implies, we need to rise up. We need to take things down from below and work our way up into the above and assert a new queen. That in itself sounds very revolutionary. It sounds almost like a coup. It effectively is a coup. I think they do reference that in the anime itself. But this arc definitely does have a coup-like feel and structure, or almost character in what it's trying to achieve. That leads me nicely in what I was going to say about how there are very different perspectives on how things are working. Eldian society obviously has these different hierarchical placements, or at least different stages within its hierarchy, and each part or section or level, I think that's the best word, has a different view of it. In the case of Uri, and we will go into Uri a bit more in detail later in the podcast, but in the case of Uri, for example, who was effectively a god or a king, he was seeing things from the top down. He was viewing things as the one on top, whereas someone like Kenny, who is known and admits he was almost a slave, and he was quite poor and not necessarily up there. This has probably been his best chance of getting up there within this arc, being a part of the military police. Kenny has been able to have this lower view. He's been able to view the uppers as different, and those contrasting perspectives are really quite interesting to have within an imperialist society. Especially when you consider imperialism usually is about the influence of the higher-ups on everything else and these districts or colonies or whatever. And so hearing the voice which usually isn't heard is a really interesting thing, as those are usually the silenced voices or the voices which aren't heard because it's absolute monarchy, and the monarch, based on their disposition, could change whatever they want and do whatever they want because of that supreme power. Kenny doesn't really have supreme power, and he's never been able to view it from the perspective of supreme power. I like how Attack on Titan does work on that, in how what we call supreme power is taken to its logical conclusion. Its idea of extreme power is literally godliness, as an almost god titan or founding titan. So I guess it does make it a bit more literal, but in itself I think that's just really smart to introduce these different and contrasting voices. I guess as we are talking about imperialism and the imperialist society, of which is Attack on Titan, I think we can kind of just go into my next point on how what is the Uprising Arc's focus and what is its intention. And I think this is probably the most clear intention in the case of Attack on Titan, because of the fact that I think this arc is a standout arc. And I don't mean standout as good. Not to say I don't like this arc, and I'll get more into my opinions as we go through the episode, but standout definitely in how it's formatted and what it attempts to do, and how it's a lot more information heavy as opposed to action heavy. It does a lot of telling as opposed to showing, and I'm fine with that. It wasn't what I was used to, considering I binged a whole 2 seasons of Attack on Titan that very summer when I was watching it, and then I got to 3rd season and I was watching it weekly on Sundays, and it wasn't that I didn't like it, it was just very different and I had to focus a lot more, and I don't think I understood it to that extent because it had already set a precedent for it being quite action heavy and you can understand what's going on through its own conflicts. But now I actually had to sit down and understand some geopolitics of Attack on Titan, and it was an interesting experience, and that's why I would say it was definitely a standout arc at least. But why am I saying standout? What is making this arc stand out? And I kind of did allude to it already, but more specifically, it's explaining the foundings of this nation. That is the core of this arc, and if you were to say it in one sentence, that would be the perfect way to explain it. It's going deeper into the foundings of this nation. This is one which is underpinned by monarchy and has seen successive generations take over and take over and take over. It's this almost infinite cycle which it's based on. But also, this arc, I think, also teaches us that there are definitely some much more nuanced ideologies within what seems to be just this bog standard, or at least very repetitive monarchist system. I don't think bog standard was the word to use at all there. But with a lot of the events, so if we take the likes of Levi and the whole thing of the Ackermans, as well as Eren's reveal and eating his father, these are things which have only been partially teased and they've been partially pushed at. But to what extent have they fully been pushed? Not very much within most of the arcs. And now we get to the Uprising arc. The Uprising arc takes a much deeper step into that. I think a good example, probably the best examples, would be the Eren example and the Ackerman example. The Ackerman example is teased within Mikasa's notion of we must fight. I address that in the Battle of the Trust District arc. We see a more visual representation, and that's kind of what I was getting to before. We see a much more visual representation of that. Imagery is one which sort of represents that resistance. And then we contrast that to now, which it's being almost told and it's being explained in a bit more detail as to who can avoid this and are you eligible to do so. And then similarly, the Eren example, I think this is a really good, and it's an easy one. It's definitely an easy example, but it's rightfully good. And that is how we don't really know what happened to Grisha Yeager per se. We just know that Eren and him had something weird happen, and obviously he's not alive today. However, that does change as we learn that he did eat his dad, and it's simple in how it's different, but it's those simple changes which make such the difference, I think, for the nuances of the show and how the destructive nature of the Titans is only continuous, and it's able to get us at a really good time when I think with all the information dumping, I want to avoid the term information dumping because I think that does sound kind of loaded in a bad sense, but anyway, when we're given all this information and we're focused on that information, you hit us with something quite sensationalist or quite snappy. That has a very different feeling as opposed to when you're surrounded by snappy content already in Attack on Titan. And I guess that was maybe one of my criticisms with the Battle of the Trost District arc. It was how I liked it and I liked its content, but it was very dependent on this shock. And the Uprising arc, I think, is very good at proving that it doesn't need to depend on such devices. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't use them and doesn't use them appropriately. So, Eren example, as I've said, the reveal just makes so much of a difference going forward for most of the show. The propaganda is being stripped from the narrative and the truth is truly coming out. And a good example of that, I would say, is the opening. The opening does prove that in how it does differ massively. Red Swan differs completely from most of the openings. And I think the reason for that is, yes, the strip back of propaganda and these notions of purity and vulnerability and childlike truth almost. An interesting question I asked to myself when I was about to record this podcast in relation to the opening was that relationship between the young Eren and the older Eren, which ignores him within the opening. And I think I don't really know the answer to that, but that sort of opened another question, and that is more of what happened between then and now to have that attitude in general. And I guess the Uprising arc does that for us. It's able to show us that gap and transition or gradient between our characters and what has built them up, as Uprising would entail, what has built them up to that point to which they are now. Same with Eldian society, what has built it up to where it is now. The part which I found most exciting when looking through this summary for the Uprising arc was probably the content to do with Uri Reis, and that is weird because when I watched the anime for the first time, and I've only seen Attack on Titan once, and I don't really rewatch shows. I do the 2x speed, 5x speed stuff to refresh my memory, but besides from that, I don't really do so because I don't have time because I'm making this podcast. But anyway, so Uri Reis, I think, was probably so interesting in how he has this very skewed approach to the narrative, and that is not what I expected. I think it was just because I simply wasn't paying enough attention during the anime, because I was still trying to get used to this whole information thing, and that's quite ironic because this was many episodes in, so. But the gist of what I'm trying to say is that Uri Reis is really interesting because of his perspective, in how, at least from what I understand, from what I read, he wishes to free humans from their quote-unquote encagement. And that's a very bad term for this climate at the moment, this medical climate. But it's a story. So removing them from their encagement. So removing them from their encagement, I think, is quite controversial in the case of what Eldian society is meant to do, which is keep them within confinement. That is doing the complete opposite. And I think this may be a link to what we discussed when discussing the Clash of the Titans arc, and how I was criticizing a lot this whole thing on imperialist society and this mindset which they're very much trapped within, and how Eren viewing certain things as bad because he's on the quote-unquote right side. We went into a whole debate on what really is the right side, and there isn't one, to be honest. The imperialist society, if anything, establishes that for you, and you take that forward because you don't know any better. But what Kenny says about Uri, or at least why I understand of Uri and Kenny's commentary on Uri, I think Uri definitely acknowledges that humanity is flawed and humanity is in grave danger within this imperialist framework. The whole thing on engagement, I think, really leapt out of the page for me. And it's also kind of ironic because he's speaking from a monarchical perspective, at least, I don't know if that's a word, but at least from a monarchist or monarch perspective. That is very weird in how we need to free them of engagement. We need to free them of what we use to limit what they know and understand. I don't know why someone would want to maintain that. I don't know why someone would want to maintain that as a monarchist. Because when you think of it, you have almost absolute control of what people think and do and act. But in today's context, particularly political, that would be seen as very yikes, because we have this whole thing on echo chambers and confirmation biases and reinforcing views. But when you have the option to do so in the place of power, it's kind of weird that they would almost reject that ultimate power. I guess that kind of just brings out the nuance of Attack on Titan, in how these ideologies aren't so black and white. These ideologies are ones which are thought out between characters, and they're not lumped upon one side as, I believe in this. And I do understand for the case of some parts, particularly, especially those characters similarly to Eren, and how they are indoctrinated, or at least, I don't know about now, but definitely before, indoctrinated with the imperial mindset of, we are strong, we are the best, and everyone else who's trying to encroach on that is somewhat evil or crazy. That makes sense, but what wouldn't be so productive, I think, would be using that brush for the rest of the ideologies. But Isayama says no to that, and he does something different, and I can completely respect that decision. And then my final thing, this is more of a bit of an insight. I don't know if it's valuable, and I don't know if Isayama used this, but it's on the Titanomachy. The Titanomachy is a part of Greek mythology, and just to say now, I am not an expert on Greek mythology. I just thought that I was doing some reading, and this seems weirdly like some of the things we read or watched within Attack on Titan 3rd season. I just saw a few parallels to how Cronus, the Titan, which the three main Greek gods, or at least them plus some others, took down, Cronus being their father, if I'm not wrong. If I am wrong, please correct me. Those parallels are quite interesting because Cronus decides to eat a lot of his children, and there are he ate more than many. Let's say that he ate most of his children, although Zeus was destined to defeat him. So the parallels are obviously the whole thing on eating and maintaining power, which is similarly to what they did within the dungeon back in the day before Grisha Yeager screwed everything up for them. And then if we look at Zeus and how he's able to defeat Cronus, it's defeating that cycle of him eating his children. It's a revolutionary act, similarly to what you can define as a revolutionary act under the likes of Grisha Yeager. And destroying that cycle, I think, does mirror these events within the Titanomachy and at least Greek mythology quite well. Also, the maybe subtext. The almost monarchical subtext, or at least the whole thing of monarchism. I don't know if we can necessarily call Greek gods monarchs, but at least they reign above those that believe in them. And these higher powers being able to control everything amongst themselves is something we kind of do see in Attack on Titan as well. Although we did have to have a coup in order to take out the government, there is still controversy and there still are problems within the system of monarchy within the society of Attack on Titan. So that was really the insight, and I think I'm going to end the analysis there. I do have one thing to say on the In the Moment segment, and it's a special one. It's not usually what I do, but I feel obliged to do this because of recent events. And I think I'm going to skip on Link the VA this week. I don't really like doing this. Not I don't like doing Link the VA. I don't like skipping it because I do really like the segment. But I also want to make this slightly easier to edit so I can get it out faster because it's already late. This won't be a recurring thing, but I just think that would be more valuable this week if I manage to get the analysis I promised to deliver you each week. So let's go to a very special, and for those that listen to the full podcast, and if you do follow me on Twitter, you will know possibly what I'm going to say. If you read the description, you already know. But here is a special In the Moment segment for this week. Okay, so for this segment, I have to tell a bit of a story. So therefore, I'm going to need to go into the stories so far. So the story so far is that on Boxing Day of last year, the 26th of December of 2019, I made a tweet saying, and I quote exactly what I said, "Bleach fans seeing that their show is trending, but finding out that it isn't coming back." I wrote that because it was basically a meme at this point, and it was fun to say. And if you have been keeping up with the anime news, Bleach now, and when I say now, I believe that was 2 days ago, so that is on the 18th of March 2020, the Thousand Year Bloody War arc is being adapted. So Bleach effectively is coming back, and therefore my tweet does not age very well. And so I took the L, and today on this In the Moment segment, I am dedicating it to the Bleach fans, and I am taking the L live on the podcast today. Okay, it's not live when you're listening to it, but I kind of am dedicating this to them. I know that there were probably some people who were being serious and handing out L's because they thought I was some sort of hater. Yeah, I wrote this in 2019 about what was initially on the hashtag, it was nothing to do with the Bleach anime or manga. It was actually to do with K-pop. And I just knew that some people think that it was Bleach in terms of the anime. And so I just decided to make a joke about it. But the crew from Bleach came at me and I kind of embraced it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be taking the L by reading a few of the clapbacks from the tweet, because my replies got not flooded, but kind of flooded. And so there are a few which I want to read out, some which won't make sense because they're pictures, but I'll try and make sense of them for you. And quickly, I just want to say, those actually made my day. I'm being honest, I'm not being ironic here. I even wrote a tweet after that. Those tweets made my day so much better. I laughed so hard, and I only mean it in good faith. I don't think many people would say this, but I'm not gonna be the guy that's like, oh, this toxic, that toxic, because I'm not accusing anyone of that. If anything, it was just hilarious to see people prove me wrong. And so I kind of just want to express that in this segment today. So let's get into the clapbacks. A really good clapback, I think, was the combo clapback. I'm not going to mention people's names, not because I think they're bad or they don't deserve attention or anything. It's just because I think naming people, it's just a bit weird. So person A says, I still believe, gotta have some faith, man. That comes from the original post back on Boxing Day. And then, which is really funny because it's been 4 months and they're still hoping for Bleach. And then they just post the announcement underneath. They're like, here's your faith, man. And that's kind of wholesome. So it's a mixture between clapback and wholesome clapback. And that was definitely a wholesome clapback right there, because he's giving him what he's effectively, or I'm assuming him, potentially he or her, has been waiting for ages. And then also wholesomely, they post that really nice Office gif where he's crying. I haven't seen The Office, so I can't give you those names, but he's doing one of those. So that was actually really wholesome for what seemed to be a clapback or response. Let's go into some other ones. One of them is just saying that this didn't age well. And I also tweeted myself that it didn't age well, because it didn't. But it's a fate joke. I think it's from Granddaughter, and I don't know the characters from Granddaughter, but it's the blonde guy who wears the turban and he's just laughing his head off on his throne. That one got me good, because when I was reading this, I was in a study session by myself and I just checked Twitter really quickly. I see 18 notifications and I just put my earphones and heard this and I kind of just cracked up really hard. I'm not gonna lie. Okay, if there's anything that has come out of this, the Bleach fans are really good at clapping back. I have to give you that. You guys are really good at dissing people, and I can only respect that, because you did really well. And there are even more out of this which just, oh, they blew me away. I can't read all of them. One of them, okay, this is funny because the guy is called Unknown, so I can call you Unknown. And he's just like, how do you feel now? And this other guy afterwards, he's like, guess what? guess what? Bleach is back, boy. There's also another one where one of the characters is giving me an L from what seems to be one of their badges. I think that's to the Soul Society badges. They're just giving me an L, so I had to absorb that passively. And then someone else copy-pasted it as well, I think. So that's funny. Someone said, B-word, best believe you can't chat anymore. They're right, I'm not going to deny that. And then the final one, my favorite clapback, which I retweeted a lot of them anyway because they were all quite good. I'm not upset by it. But to be honest, the more I say I'm not upset by it, it makes me sound like I'm upset. But the best one, and I'm not going to say their name just because let's leave it at that. But the best one comes from this guy, and he puts what I believe to be a panel from the manga. And the character is saying, and hopefully there are Bleach fans which can tell me about this in the audience. I hope you are. And the character is just saying, how long have you been under the delusion that we were cancelled? I laughed insanely hard. This was when I got home after the study session. And I just checked my phone again and more of them were coming through. And I just had to quote tweet this one because it was so good. How do you have the perfect panel to destroy me? I don't get it. How did you have the perfect panel from the manga just to use that as the ultimate diss? I guess that shows how much effort Kubo really did put into Bleach, to be honest. He thought about this. He thought that this was going to be used to cancel me. And so, just to end the segment, that was probably one of the funnest moments I've had on Twitter in a long time. And I've had some thoughts about doing a Twitter segment. I'm thinking of maybe when we get halfway within this potential season of Guess in the Mecha. I'm intending to do season 2 after 100 episodes rather than doing it small seasons. Nothing will really change. It's still going to be a week by week show. I'm not really intending to do it in blocks, but I'm thinking on our second Kerr, which will be after episode 50, I'm intending to maybe switch up the segments, and so I might actually try a few things out. That will be really fun, but this segment for me has been really fun, and hopefully you did enjoy it. I know it was a bit limiting because you can't see them, but if you do want to see them, shameless self-plug, be sure to check out the Twitter page of Get to the Mecha, or basically just my Twitter, that's what it is. Be sure to check that out. That is at Get in the Mecha. Simple as. Be sure to check it out and you can see all the clapbacks and all the amazing ways they managed to show that I was wrong. So let's finish this podcast. Let's go to some closing thoughts on the Uprising arc. And then we can say goodbye for this one session. So what do I think of the Uprising arc? I've begun to like it a lot more than I previously did. I used to think that this was potentially, after the Clash of the Titans arc for me personally, my least favorite arc in the show, but I think there are some really interesting takeaways which we can get from this. A lot of nuance in regards to the ideas and ideologies of characters. Especially that one thing which I think I did forget to mention, but even Kenny saying that everyone is a slave to something, and Kenny being a lot more literal in regards to himself, but when he refers to Uri and how Uri was a slave to ideology, I think that statement in itself is something which can go for the entire show. It's, what are we a slave to? And specifically, slavery to ideology is one which is definitely a key theme within the show as a whole. In comparison to the Clash of the Titans arc, we're definitely seeing a movement in what we perceive to be the truth, as the truth is becoming more and more defined and becoming what we can potentially define as more and more quote-unquote objective, as opposed to having a lot more biased opinions in regards to our position simply because we believe we're right. The Uprising arc definitely takes a different approach to most of the arcs of Attack on Titan, but as a result, I think it does pay off in introducing and exemplifying multiple ideas which have been developed earlier in the show. Thank you for listening to this episode of Guest in the Mecha. That has been episode 36. Hopefully you did enjoy it. I know I skipped the VA. I'm very sorry. We'll be coming back next week. Everything going okay. Unless we're doing a manga episode, which might actually happen. But for the next anime episode, we will be doing a Link the VA, assuming it's on an arc or something like that. As always, stay safe. I know it's very stressful at the moment, and I will try my best to keep you guys entertained and keep that analysis coming out each week. Be sure to check out the Mecha PSA. It's just a good reminder on how to stay safe during these tasking times. If everything goes okay, I should have that linked in the show notes. Also, as always, thank you for all the support. The 1,000 listens means a lot. Whether it's loads of you guys or only a few of you guys coming back each and every episode, that is a dialogue, really, a one-sided dialogue, but still, that's a dialogue I'm having with you, and I find a lot of value from that. So stay safe, thank you for listening, have a good week. If you're staying inside, keep yourself busy. I'm gonna stop lecturing you guys. You guys are, I assume, much older than me already. So you guys know what to do. Thank you for listening. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows: JRPG 2 Piano by Joth, 8-bit Title Screen by Joth, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Difference by Chasers Gaming, and Anomaly, Barrack Media's UnderSoundImage.org.